Mic.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next case on the court's oral calendar this morning is Nelson v. Is it Rikes? Rikes?
It is Ricks, Your Honor.
Ricks. I'm sorry, wrong both ways. I will let you know that we're doing our hearing by Zoom platform today. I'm sure you're aware. I don't know if you've been on a Zoom hearing before. Our rules of procedure are the same. Each attorney will have 15 minutes to make arguments on behalf of his client. Respondent will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal. We'll let each of you get started with about 3 minutes of uninterrupted time. During that time, please let us know the relief you seek and the grounds for that relief, and perhaps identify those arguments that you think are strongest or most important for the court's attention this morning. Please assume we're familiar with the factual record as well as the procedural record, and that we'll ask questions about those facets of the case if we have them. Each attorney should be sure to introduce himself and his client for the record before beginning argument. And with that, we'll turn to counsel for appellant. Mr. Kluber, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Douglas Kluber. I represent the appellants, Dwight and Robin Ricks, in this matter. The issue before the court stems from a house, a sale by the appellants of their home to the respondents. There subsequent to the sale, about 5 months afterwards, there became an issue with a sewer pipe. And upon that issue, the respondents compelled arbitration based on an arbitration clause contained in the purchase agreement. The main issue that the appellants have is that in order to have a proper arbitration, there must be an agreement to arbitrate, and that the purchase agreement, which formed the basis of that agreement to arbitrate, the clause in the purchase agreement had merged as well as the other clauses in the purchase agreement had merged at the time they sought enforcement of it. And so we don't believe that the arbitrator had authority to arbitrate under the agreement. The
Mr.
relief-
Kluber, yes. I'm hoping that, and sorry to interrupt you just as you're about to tell us the relief that you're seeking, but I am wondering if you could, as concisely as possible, explain why the survival clause means that the presumption of merger is not, in fact, overcome in this case, and that the purchase agreement arbitration clause applies.
Yes, Your Honor. The survival clause in this case, there were two, they are specific to what survives. So merger is what occurs when the deed is delivered. And unless there's a survival clause of some sort, the claims arising under that purchase agreement are extinguished. And so in this case, it was very specific what would survive. Actions that could only be taken after the deed was delivered, they would survive according to the survival clause, and also warranties would survive. So nothing else in the document survives after the delivery of the deed, and so that is why that includes the arbitration clause, it includes the attorney's fees clause. All of that was not in existence. Thank you. The relief that we are requesting today is that this court order the district court to vacate the arbitrator's award. In the alternative, I believe we've also requested that, not so much in the alternative, but all the court could vacate the award and remand the matter back for mediation if it finds that that purchase agreement did survive and did not merge. Because if the purchase agreement did not merge, then all of the terms didn't merge. And there is a mandatory mediation requirement that had to happen. And unless the issues needed to be, according to the terms, submitted to mediation first. And anything that was not not successfully mediated, then an arbitrator would have jurisdiction to arbitrate those issues. In our case, prior to the arbitration, my clients who were unrepresented at the time did try to assert this mediation clause and brought it to the arbitrator's attention and said, we want our mandatory mediation. The arbitrator denied that request. And I think that this points out a lot of the issues with these arbitration clauses, which many times people don't realize are even in there. And that would go more to what whether you really waive, make a knowing and intelligent waiver of your right to the courts. But there's a pecuniary interest that arbitrators have in going forward with the arbitration, where it appears that what an arbitrator should have done is looked at the merged document and said, well, we don't really have an agreement to arbitrate here. I can't arbitrate this. And, or in the alternative, say there's a condition precedent here that this be submitted to formal mediation. I can't arbitrate these issues until it's gone through formal mediation as per the party's agreement. And so
Yes. Are you suggesting that mediation couldn't have been waived by the parties?
I believe mediation could have been waived by the parties, but there was no indication here in the facts here that my clients ever waived the right to mediation. This was something that, again, now we have an arbitrator making a decision that it would be that mediation would be not fruitful. This, there was no agreement for the arbitrator to make that decision. Yes.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. But given the timing of when they raised the issue of mediation, why wasn't it proper for the arbitrator to conclude that they had waived it, given the late timing of raising that issue?
Well, first of all, I don't think waiver is something that is passive. I think if they waived mediation, that's something they would actively had to have done. I just don't believe that you can call a denial of their right after they're asserting a right to mediation a waiver. They're clearly they were aware of the clause and they were trying to enforce it, but it goes more to the actions of the mediator, or I'm sorry, the arbitrator, because it's the arbitrator who has the responsibility of arbitrating issues that are within his scope. The arbitrator had the responsibility to look at that and say, there's a condition precedent here. This needs to happen before I, as an arbitrator, have the authority to arbitrate these
and
issues.
Speaking of condition precedent, I find the language of the mediation clause and the arbitration clause when considered together doesn't necessarily weigh in favor of your argument that this is a condition precedent. And specifically, what is of concern to me is in the arbitration clause, it states that if the parties are unable to resolve themselves or through mediation, and it's that or that suggests to me that perhaps the mediation paragraph is not, in fact, a condition precedent. Can you address that concern?
Yes, I can. That is just simply providing for the fact that these will be issues will either be resolved between the parties, which the parties are always free to resolve issues between themselves, or through mediation for those issues that are not resolved between the parties. And I don't think that diminishes the mandatory requirement, because the language of the mediation clause is clear, and it says the parties will submit these issues to mediation, not that they may, or not that not that they can skip it altogether, or nor does it even talk about waiver. So I don't agree that the arbitration clause somehow negates the mandatory nature of the mediation clause.
What about the fact that your clients actually acquiesced ultimately in the arbitration and made no legal challenge to the arbitrator's decision to go forward with the arbitration and not to send this to mediation? What are we to make of that fact? And I understand that you've observed that these individuals were not represented, but what's your best argument against their acquiescence?
Well, I think the best argument this isn't about what my clients did or didn't do. The problem lies here in what the arbitrator did. This is about an arbitrator's misconduct, not any missteps or misconduct or failures on my client's part. It's, did the arbitrator have the authority to arbitrate what he chose to arbitrate using a merged purchase agreement as a basis for an agreement to mediate, and then essentially rewriting the party's agreement so that he could go forward with his arbitration. And that's the very difficult part of this, is because unlike a district court judge, you don't have that arbitrator with a pecuniary interest in moving forward. This is how arbitrators make money. They don't, you know, they're not, you just lose that independence that we have from district court judges. So I think that arbitrators do have to be, or they have to be held to a higher standard, where they are actually following and making sure that they have a right to arbitrate the issues that are put in front of them. So essentially, the question I think it comes down to is can a purchase agreement be resurrected at any time after, and all the clauses therein, even if there isn't a specific savings clause to save it, can that be resurrected to use as a basis for the arbitration agreement? And if it can, is an arbitrator allowed to disregard whatever clauses he chooses in that document? I don't believe that the arbitrator can do either of those things. Another issue that's a part of this too is, again, with the arbitrator exceeding the scope when he's looking at this and saying, well, I think there's violations of statute or some statutory requirement here. The arbitrator, again, is bound by violations of whatever agreement, the agreement that the parties had to mediate, and what issues would be mediated. So if he's saying that I have a right to mediate the terms of a purchase agreement, that doesn't mean a mediator has the right, or an arbitrator, I'm sorry, has the right to say, well, I'm also going to arbitrate allegation that a disclosure might violate some statutory obligation. That, again, is beyond the scope. And the scope is defined by the agreement of the parties. So again, if we don't really have an agreement, we don't have a scope, and so we don't have anything to arbitrate. Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm having a difficult time unmuting, pardon me. We'll now hear from counsel for respondent. Please identify yourself for the record before beginning.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is David Johnson. I'm the attorney for the respondents, Robbie and Duncan Nelson. May it please the court. You asked for what we would like for the relief sought, and we would like the district court order to be affirmed as it relates to the arbitration agreement is valid, as it relates to the award and confirming the award. Everything in that order should be affirmed, except we have a related appeal on their denial of attorney's fees. Now, attorney's fees is a big component here. The initial arbitrator's award was, you know, roughly $16,000, and the arbitrator awarded $4,000 plus in attorney's fees. They brought a motion in district court to vacate the award of the arbitrator. We did a counter motion to confirm that, and it was confirmed, and we were again awarded attorney's fees on that. Okay, so the third motion that they brought has to do with the motion for the new trial and the amended findings. And while they denied that motion, the attorney's fees, our motion for attorney's fees was also denied. And I believe that that's error because of the contractual language of the purchase agreement. There is no discretion in the attorney's fees provision of the purchase agreement. It says the prevailing party shall be awarded attorney's fees. The district court judge made a finding, something to the effect of, it is improper at this stage of the proceeding to award either party attorney's fees. I do believe that that was error because of the language in the attorney's fees.
Mr. Johnson, doesn't the language also refer to reasonable attorney's fees?
The language in the purchase agreement says the reasonable attorney's fees should be awarded to the prevailing party.
So did you demonstrate that the fees that you requested were reasonable?
They didn't make a finding on that. And you know, the whole thing here is that my clients have spent more on attorney's fees than the award itself. So if you don't get an award of attorney's fees, they're really not made whole at all for the non-disclosure that this whole thing was based on.
Could I follow up on the question of Judge Cochran? Did you submit to the district court records documenting your claim for attorney fees, your hourly rate, the work you performed, how it related to the litigation? So you did make those submissions, the Lodestar method submissions that we would typically expect.
Yes, Your Honor, we did. The affidavit of attorney's fees set out, we just included a redacted bill for everything that we did.
Thank you.
Have the normal Lodestar method. So that was all done. And so, you know, it's clear, and there's attorney's fees to be awarded both under the contract and purchase agreement and under Minnesota Statute 572, which is the arbitration statute. Now, that's discretionary. They don't have, the judge does not have to do it under that statute, but they do have to do it under the contract. And I guess the argument is that it wasn't reasonable. You know, if you end up with your client paying, you know, more attorney's fees than they're awarded to the extent of the initial judgment, it's not unreasonable. And this thing has been prolonged. It's been litigated to every extent. You know, this was initially, you know, if it had been paid initially, it'd been cheaper for everybody, and my clients would have had an actual award. So I think those attorney fee arguments apply to, the related appeal regarding the district court judgment. We've also filed a motion here at the Court of Appeals regarding attorney's fees. So I think the same arguments apply, and this is all related to enforcing the purchase agreement. Reasonable attorney's fees will be awarded, and I don't see any discretion there. So, you know, in an effort to have my clients become whole on this, attorney's fees do need to be awarded. So that's what we're asking for relief sought. I kind of made my argument already on the related appeal. Again, there's two components to that, the contractual attorney's fees and the statutory attorney's fees. We've also got, you know, plenty of arguments in contrast to the appellant's arguments on the, you know, on their case in chief.
Mr. Johnson, before you turn to that, can I ask you about the award of attorney's fees by the arbitrator? The purchase agreement language provides that the prevailing party of any action at law or in equity brought to enforce or interpret this agreement will be entitled to reasonable attorney's fees and costs. And so my question for you is the prevailing party in an arbitration a prevailing party in any action at law or in equity? And I'll note that Black's Law Dictionary defines action as a civil or criminal judicial proceeding.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe under the arbitration statute, the arbitrator has authority to handle all actions at law and in equity. So Judge Hansen actually cited the state auditor case, State Auditor versus Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, 504 Northwest 2nd at 751, for the proposition that the arbitrator does have this authority. He made a quote in his order quoting that case, that said, generally, arbitrators serve as the final judge of both law and fact, including interpretation of the terms of the contract. So I believe that that answers your question about whether this is a law or arbitrators, has the authority to make that attorney's fees. And I believe that clearly he does. I think they have the authority to do anything that a judge would have to do under that reasoning.
Thank you.
The appellant makes four claims, basically, that the arbitration agreement was void, that it was beyond the scope of the arbitration agreement to enforce the statutory requirements, and then it was beyond it to award attorney's fees. And then finally, that the mediation, was the fact that the arbitrator denied the mediation, the last minute mediation claim. Those are the four arguments that they make. And three of those four have to do with this merger doctrine, which the appellant really doesn't cite any cases, any statutes, any law at all in support of his propositions here that the purchase agreement provisions merged into the deed. There's a survival clause. There's two survival clauses. And the judge relied on those survival clauses in his order. And really, we're looking at, in this appeal, we're really looking at what the judge did, not what the arbitrator did. The standard of review has to do with whether the judge properly applied 572D, which is a different standard than looking directly at the arbitrator's actions. But in any event, the arbitrator's actions were supported by law. Excuse me. Back to the merger arguments, there clearly is a survival clause, and I don't know how that argument is being made. I think counsel made the argument that only certain provisions merge, but he didn't have any support for that. He didn't say which provisions merge. Clearly an arbitration agreement is a part of many residential purchase agreements, and his argument basically make all of those meaningless and void, all of the purchase agreements down in the state of Minnesota. And clearly that's not an intended result. So regarding, the arbitration merger, the statutory requirements, that is the whole disclosure statutes under Minnesota statute 513.55. Now, I'm not by any means agreeing that any of these representations in the purchase agreement merge, but even if they did, even if there weren't, there's still obligations under the statute, under 513.55, completely apart from any purchase agreement, any contractual representations that the failure to disclose. So, even without that, he's saying that's beyond the scope of the arbitration agreement. Well, again, as Judge Hansen cited, the arbitrator has the authority to do this by law. Minnesota Statute 513.55, even if all the other representations went away, which they don't, they would still have that statute to rely on to make their claim. And then the award of attorney's fees, it's the same analysis.
Mr. Jensen, could you address Mr. Kluver's argument that the mediation provision was somehow a condition precedent to arbitration?
Yes, Your Honor. And again, we're looking at whether the judge properly applied the statute, and the judge said that the arbitrator made the decision that it was waived. And there's a process in this arbitration. There's pretrial. We have pretrial conferences with the appellants. There is a process, a statutory process, to bring these, you know, whether arbitration is viable in front of the court. You can file that court apart from the arbitration process if they don't want to arbitrate. All that was waived. And again, we had, and the judge had referred to the fact that we've had plenty of discussions. There was efforts of settlement among the parties, and that's part of the, you know, the mediation and the arbitration clause itself. I don't think it is a condition precedent, because it said if they can't settle by themselves or through arbitration, then you go to or through mediation, then you go to arbitration. So clearly I don't believe that there is a firm requirement to mediate. But even if there was, it could certainly be waived, and it was waived under the circumstances. You know, the timeliness of this motion, this was brought up the day of the arbitration, you know, 5 minutes before we were set to begin. So it certainly wasn't timely. But I don't believe that mediation is a condition precedent to arbitration because of the language in the arbitration mediation clause of the purchase agreement. So, yeah, I mean, most of what I'm seeing here, again, there's arguments that they're making that it just merges and it should just go away. But, you know, throughout the whole brief and today, there's really no citation supporting his arguments. I mean, I don't see any law on any of this. There just isn't a basis for it. I mean, there's not a basis for a reversal of this. I do believe there is a basis for a reversal of our related appeal on the attorney's fees. As I've gone through, I'm not going to restate that argument. But yes, the mediation, we had a pre-hearing phase that it should have been brought up at, and it was not an exact condition precedent on that. So I don't know, unless the court has more questions for me, I don't know that I need to that I'm going to use the rest of my time. So thank you for allowing me to argue.
I don't see any additional questions. So we thank you for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Initially, about these attorney's fees, this is not complicated at all. This is contained in the document. The paragraph 20 of the arbitration clause says the parties will share the cost of arbitration equally. I don't know how the court ever thought that was okay to award attorney's fees for an arbitration where there was clearly, it was already spelled out that the parties need to share that cost equally. In addition, the real important language here on the attorney's fees clause, which is paragraph 18 of the party's purchase agreement, is the party of any action at law or in equity brought to enforce or interpret this agreement. There was no action to the court that was brought to enforce or interpret this agreement. The action that was brought to the court was to confirm or vacate an award of an arbitrator. That is certainly not contemplated in this type of language. And so the court was absolutely correct in not awarding fees, and the fees that the court did award were absolutely improper. There was no authority in the party's agreement that allowed him to do that, even aside from the merger doctrine. And the same problem that the court had in reading fully the attorney's fees issue, the court had in reading these savings clause, the survival clauses, the survival of warranties. We're not talking about a warranty here. We're not talking about any warranty that my clients made. So that warranty survival of warranties clause is not applicable because we're not talking about warranties. Likewise, the next one is the terms of the agreement, the survival clause that impose an obligation on either party after delivery of the deed to the buyer will continue to survive until satisfied. We're not talking about any of that. We're talking about a claim of non-disclosure occurring prior to the deed being delivered. We're not talking about whether they had an obligation in there to put a new roof on the structure and whether they did. That's why those that survival and those warranty paragraphs, they only apply to warranties and to these other these other things. It didn't apply to the whole document. Otherwise, from a policy perspective, we have a whole bunch of zombie purchase agreements now.
Mr. Kluver, can you identify the warranties that you think are within the scope of the survival clause?
There is a specific paragraph in the purchase agreement that contains warranties. 13 says seller representations and warranties. And that spells out any warranty that is being given. A general warranty that warrants that the property is free of all title defects, except as those stated on the deed. That's in paragraph 13A. That's the warranty. Seller representations are what it talks about later on in that. But again, seller representations are not what is covered under the savings clause. The savings clause only says the warranties survive.
So a duty to disclose, in your view, is related to the representations made by the seller, not the warranties?
Correct. That's why they call them seller representations and warranties. They're the representations are apart from the warranties. And any representation they should have made is not covered under the savings clause, just like clearly no attorney's fees clauses are covered in the savings clause, yet we keep resurrecting these defunct provisions of a merged purchase agreement. I see I'm almost out of time. Thank you.
All right, thank you to the attorneys for your briefing and your arguments and answering our questions this morning. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days. That concludes the court's oral calendar this morning. The panel will now turn to its non-oral cases. Thank you.